from WNYC New York Public Radio. This is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show. This is just one segment of the program. You can hear all Leonard's interviews on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
For today's edition of Please Explain, we have two guests here with so much brain power between them, your radio may be crackling. Together, they are going to explain in ways we hope anyone can understand how gravity works, what black holes are, and what string theory is, and possibly much more, because later we'll be taking your questions. Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, and the author of many books, including most recently Origins, 14 Billion Years of Cosmic History. And Michio Kaku is a theoretical physicist and professor in the Graduate Department of Physics at the City University of New York, author of many books, including most recently Parallel Worlds, A Journey Through Creation, Higher Dimensions, and the Future of the Cosmos. And I'm very pleased to welcome them both back to the Leonard Lopate Show. Hi.
Hello.
Glad to be on.
Yeah.
We asked you here today in part because we were intrigued, and so were some of our listeners, by a New York Times piece which reported that a star three times the size of our sun had been spotted flinging itself out of our galaxy at a fantastic rate, 1.5 million miles per hour. Can you tell us a bit more about that, Neil?
Yeah. Stars don't often pick up that kind of velocity unless something really traumatic happened to them. And this one we trace to an event back at the center of the galaxy. Oh, by the way, the principal scientist in this is Warren Brown up at the Center for Astrophysics up at Harvard. And
he spotted this star
moving
fast?
All these stars are sitting there in the sky, and we don't live long enough to watch them move anywhere, and so you have to get spectra of them, and you analyze the light that you receive from these stars, and from that analysis, in something akin to what the police radar gun does, you look at the light coming to us from it, and you can judge how fast the thing is moving. And you look at where it's coming from. And we conclude that this thing came from the center of the galaxy, where we know lurks a supermassive black hole. And black holes wreak havoc on their environment. And one of the things they'll do is, if a star is in a binary system, our sun is just a single star, but most of the stars you see in the night sky are double or multiple, triple, quadruple star systems. If you have a pair of stars that flies a little too close to a black hole, then they can lose their gravitational allegiance to each other. And in so doing, one of them will fall into the black hole, kicking the other one out with tremendous velocity. And this thing...
So it kind of slingshot.
It's like a slingshot effect. And this one that's flying out is going twice the speed of the escape velocity of the galaxy. So it's gone forever. It's kissing goodbye.
How often does this sort of thing happen?
We think it happens all the time. By the way, the idea of kicking a star out of a system is not new. We have star clusters, globular clusters that have maybe 100,000 stars in them. You can have what we call three-body encounters, a pair of stars flinging by another star, and one star gets robbed, the other gets kicked out. And we call it the evaporation of a cluster.
But we don't read about it in the newspaper all the time.
Well, because somebody has to be intrigued by it. And in this case, it was, I forgot who wrote it for the New York Times. Who was it? It was Dennis Overby. He thought that was intriguing enough to tell people about it, and I think it is. But there are other intriguing things in the universe, too. So it's a pick and choose, and depending on what other current events are competing for all the space there to fit your news.
Michio, the reason we even know there are blacks holes is through mathematics. Isn't that true?
That's right. Black holes are invisible. And people ask the question, well, how do you know there's a black hole there when light itself cannot escape? You know that when you throw a baseball into the sky, that it eventually comes back to Earth. But if you throw a baseball at 25,000 miles per hour, it doesn't come back to Earth. That's escape velocity. That's what it would take to jump to the moon, 25,000 miles per hour.
That's what rocket ships need to get out of our gravitational pull?
That's right. If you could jump at 25,000 miles per hour, you could jump to the moon. and escape the Earth's gravity. If you could then run at almost a million miles an hour, you could leave the Milky Way galaxy itself. And that's what this star did when it was flung out of a black hole.
But I want to get back to the whole business of black holes being predicted by math, because this is something that has always confused me. Somebody comes up with a complicated equation, Einstein, and I look at it and I don't get anything, but I'm sure that people who are very sophisticated get a lot out of it. But somebody says, well, this suggests that there are black holes. Now, how do a bunch of numbers and symbols then come to mean that there are black holes? And did Einstein understand that when he was writing out the equation?
Well, black holes actually go back to a person named John Mitchell several hundred years ago, looking at Newton's laws of motion. Newton knew, of course, if you threw this baseball fast enough, it's not going to come back to Earth. But John Mitchell asked the question, what happens if I throw a baseball at the speed of light? What kind of star would it take so that even light itself would come back and land back on the star? And so he did the first calculation of a black hole using just ordinary Newtonian physics. And a black hole would then not allow light itself to escape. Then in 1915, in November of 1915,
The term black hole was not yet coined even in his day.
Nobody was right. taking the idea very seriously, I suspect.
Yeah. They called them dark stars in those days. Mm-hmm. And then in 1915, Einstein came out with this fantastic theory of general relativity, where gravity is actually a byproduct of the curvature of space. And then just a few months later, get this, a few months later, there was a German physicist who actually worked out a solution of Einstein's equations for a star, an exact solution of Einstein's equation for a star, which was the equation for the black hole. So the black hole equation actually dates to 1916 when Carl Schwarzschild, using pure mathematics, took the equations of Einstein, which are nothing but 1 inch long. They're an equation 1 inch long that governs the Big Bang, black holes, the evolution of the universe. The birth and death of the universe are encoded in an equation 1 inch long that also gives you the black hole solution, which was, as I mentioned, was originally seen in Newton's equations.
So you're saying that Einstein could come up with these equations but not understand the full implications of them. Other mathematicians and physicists then look at those equations and say, well, if this equals this, then that implies that.
Yeah, I would say that I wouldn't quite say that he wouldn't understand the full implications. It's that it might take other people to fully exploit the full power of the equations that he came up with. And what people often think is that math, particularly when you're in school, people think math is just thrown at you just to make you angry. But in fact,
to confuse me.
But in fact, any idea that you come forth, that you bring forth on the universe or how the universe works, if you don't have a mathematical representation of that idea, then you have no assurance that as you manipulate your thoughts, that your manipulated thoughts will draw logically from your initial parameters. Whereas if you have a mathematical image of it, then you can manipulate the equations and deduce things from those equations, knowing that one step follows logically from the next. And that's the power of the math.
But why math? Why can't I just simply come up with an idea that there's, because of certain things that are being observed by telescopes, that there must be a black hole?
At some point you're going to want to measure that. You want to know, what is the mass of that black hole? How big is it? How fast is it moving? How fast is it rotating? So the fact that there would be a black hole in words from an idea, that's fine. But in the end, what you want to do is, the real understanding is going to come from these measurements and from these calculations.
My guests on today's Please Explain here on the Leonard Lopez Show on WNYC 93.9 AM 820 and WNYC.org are Neil deGrasse Tyson, the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. His most recent book is Origins, 14 Billion Years of Cosmic History. And Michio Kaku, a professor in the Graduate Department of Physics at the City University of New York. His most recent book, Parallel Worlds, A Journey Through Creation, Higher Dimensions, and the Future of the Cosmos. Now, my image of a black hole is of a huge vacuum cleaner that just sucks things in. Is that a fair description?
I'm going to hand off to Michio in a second, but let me start this off by saying there's a fun joke where they say, there's no such thing as gravity. Earth sucks. So people think of gravity as these giant sucking machines, but in fact, no, there's a field, the gravity field out there, and if you have enough movement to the side of that object, you'll just either go into orbit around it or might get your trajectory altered a bit. But
so it won't suck everything.
Just because you have strong gravity doesn't mean you're going to suck up the whole universe. But Michio, take him somewhere.
Well, actually, gravity doesn't suck, according to Einstein. Space pushes. The black hole is so enormous that it actually warps the space around it so that everything falls in. The famous example is a bowling ball placed on a bedsheet. The bowling ball sinks into the bedsheet. So the bowling ball doesn't really suck in marbles that orbit around the bowling ball. It's the mattress that pushes marbles as they go around the bowling ball. So the Earth's gravity doesn't pull you to the floor. I'm not sitting in this chair because gravity pulls me to the floor. Space pushes me down into the chair. Now, I also want to say that sometimes the math takes you into realms that are so fantastic that even the originators of the equations can't believe it. Einstein himself did not believe in black holes until very, very late. He actually wrote a paper saying that black holes cannot exist because if star matter fell into a swirling mass of stars, it would not form a black hole. It took Oppenheimer, the man who built the atomic bomb, to show that a dead star will implode, actually collapse under its own gravity, giving you a black hole. And many people think that that paper of Oppenheimer led to the atomic bomb, because that is precisely the secret of the implosion mechanism of the Nagasaki bomb.
But I'm still a bit confused. Okay, so the black hole doesn't suck in everything, but it still is a very powerful force of gravitational force. And yet we have been told that the universe is expanding, in fact, accelerating its expansion. I would have thought that a black hole in the center of the Milky Way would be slowing that down or pulling things back in.
I think the way you need to approach the problem is, let's think of the sun. Here we are in happy orbit around the sun. There is, if we had sort of magic hands, we could turn the sun into a black hole. If we did that, Earth would get very cold very quickly. But if we didn't otherwise change the mass of the sun, we'd still go in orbit around it like nothing happened. Our solid body Earth would still go into orbit around, would retain the orbit we now have around the sun. The difference about a black hole in the universe is now you can get much closer to the center of the object than you could have before. And that's where the extra gravity and the fireworks that take place in the galaxy occur. Here we are, the sun, the solar system in orbit around the center of the galaxy. Who cares if there's a black hole down there? We don't care. But if you're a star that gets close to it, that's where you feel the extreme effects of the curvature of space, this high force of gravity that's there.
You'll be sucked in, and then what happens?
Well, we mentioned that a star, the twin of this star, actually fell into the black hole. And so where did it go? Well, there's a lot of debate about this. We physicists are not agreed, but there is one theory that says that perhaps it's blown out the other end.
That would be a wormhole, wouldn't it?
A wormhole through a white hole. Now, again, if you look at the equations say, and this is rather fantastic, that there is another universe on the other end of this sinkhole. So think of all these things going down the drain of a kitchen sink, but then the kitchen sink flanges out into another kitchen top.
Michio, is it fair to think of that as the negative solution to the black hole?
A time reverse solution is a white hole.
And you'd connect those then with a wormhole.
That's right.
Fair enough to say it that way?
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Take two parallel sheets of paper, and the two parallel sheets of paper never interact with each other. Then stick a pencil through it so that you now have a gateway between these two parallel sheets of paper. And that is the solution that mathematician Roy Kerr, found in 1963. So if you follow the math, if you just follow the math, you're led into an Alice in Wonderland world where there could be multiple universes, parallel stages, and that when matter falls into a black hole, perhaps it's simply blown out the other end into a baby universe. Think of two soap bubbles connected together like with an umbilical cord, two Siamese twins, two soap bubbles connected together by a black hole.
Well, okay, so the math suggests that. And math has suggested all sorts of other things, as we've seen with string theory. But is there any way to prove that any of this is true? Can we come up with scientific tests that might indicate that there is a parallel universe?
Well, physicists used to snicker at string theorists and other people who look at these things. Because
some people still do snicker at string theorists.
they still do.
Again, because you can't prove it, it's all about math, isn't it?
Well, in the year 2011, all this may change. LISA goes up in orbit. NASA gave the final approval. It's the Laser Interferometry Space Antenna, a multi-million dollar satellite, the most advanced satellite system conceived of by the human mind. It'll be a system of three satellites 3 million miles across, connected by laser beams that will detect the shock wave, the original shock wave of Genesis itself, which is still reverberating around our soap bubble. And we will, in some sense, have baby pictures of the instant when the universe was created, and perhaps we'll detect the presence of an umbilical cord connecting our baby universe, perhaps, to a parent universe. The sensitivity is so great that it can differentiate between inflation-type theories, string-type theories, M-theory-type theories. It could be the final word, we hope, that will one day either resolve or not resolve the question of string theory and M theory. And that's just in 6 years' time. And so we may have the first experimental data verifying the existence of a parallel universe.
But I want to get back to the math thing, because I'm not sure I get it completely. So the sense that I have is that people do very sophisticated mathematical equations, and they come up with ideas like parallel universes, black holes, they could just be playing games. They're coming up with these wonderful equations, and their guess is as good as the next guess. Why is that any different than somebody writing a science fiction book or making a painting that shows a parallel universe?
Yeah, I think there's an important part of this. There's the science that as the universe unfolds and you have these math tools, you say, oh, I can apply this math tool to understand what I see. And that's how most of the science gets done. But if you're at the edge of our understanding of how the universe works, then we're testing the very limits of our theories. And the limits of our theories can be tested in two ways. One of them by observation. Another one is, where do the equations take you? And what I find intriguing about this community of string theorists is a lot of what they're describing is unmeasurable by any foreseeable means of science or experiment. Yet if you keep working the equations on the assumption that your first ideas are correct, you keep working the equations, you try to get to a regime where we can test a prediction. And that's where the fun part is. Because then, if Michio can come to me and say, Neil, I just worked out the 12th line, 15th line of this equation, and we should be able to discover this in the galaxy. I'm going to go look for it. And if I find it, that gives Michio some confidence that the other steps that led up to that might also be true. And therein is the growth of a whole intellectual movement.
Before we go to calls, Michio, what were the limits of Einstein's theories? What couldn't he explain?
He couldn't explain two things. One was the instant of the Big Bang itself, and the second was the center of a black hole. There, the gravitational fields are so immense that radiation effects start to come in, and you have to introduce another theory called the quantum theory, which handles radiation. And when you combine the quantum theory with Einstein's theory, you get a mess.
Yeah, they don't reconcile.
We've been stuck for 50 years trying to combine Einstein's beautiful theories of bed sheets and curved surfaces with the quantum theory of particles and radiation effects. But that's the most interesting thing, and that's where string theory comes in. It is the only theory which allows you to go back before the Big Bang. It allows you to go through the black hole itself. It's a finite theory that eliminates.
Lewis Carroll would have loved this, because it is the theory of the rabbit hole. Right, where everything gets mysterious.
That's right. We're essentially going through the looking glass.
Right.
String theory allows you to trace the physics through the looking glass in a finite way without being zapped by radiation effects.
It's my sense that Einstein's theories are based on the tangible and quantum on the intangible, where you have a situation where you have something being a dot and a wave at the same time and being in two different places at the same time. One, I can kind of understand as a layperson. The other I just have to take on faith. And is that one of the reasons that you can't reconcile the two?
No. You see, the quantum theory says that things have a certain probability of happening. You don't really know for sure where an electron is. It can be two places at the same time. And all chemistry, all electronics, the laser beam, this radio program, the internet, all of it is based on the idea that an electron can be two places at the same time. Now, once upon a time, the universe was smaller than an electron. So if electrons can be many places at the same time, and that's why we have laser beams, and that's why we have WNYC radio, then why can't the universe exist in many parallel states? And that's the multiverse idea, that the universe can obey the same physics as an electron, that if electrons can dance in many possible states, which we call modern chemistry, then why can't the universe also create a chemistry of universes, and that's called the multiverse? That's where the equations take us, far beyond anything that Einstein conceived of. But if you follow the equations, just like you follow the money during the Watergate scandal, if you follow the equations, that's where you're inevitably led to go, into the multiverse.
I've got to add to that real briefly that the non-tangibility of quantum mechanics, it was the 20th century where we learned that no longer can you invoke what you call common sense, what we all call common sense, as a prerequisite for whether a physical theory is correct or not, because we're experimenting regimes that fall completely outside of the five senses that we grew up with. And so even though it's bizarre, wave, particle, it's here or there, both places at once, it doesn't matter that that confuses us all. What matters is, can you predict the nature of the universe based on these constructs? And the fact is, you can. You can predict with higher precision than any theory that has come before it or since. Quantum theory is one of the most successful concepts ever put forth in the annals of physics. So the real problem is not so much quantum mechanics, but general relativity. That's the shortcoming. Isn't that right, Michio?
Yeah, that's right. Quantum mechanics gives us modern electronic society. Computers, transistors, diodes, all of that comes out of the quantum theory. Our economy would collapse without the quantum theory. People say, what has it done for me lately? Better color television? And the answer is yes. The quantum theory gives you better color television. It's general relativity that gives us all sorts of conniptions, because we talk about universes now. When you quantize a universe, you get multiple universes.
We have to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll be taking questions from our audience. Michio Kaku is with us on this Please Explain segment. He's a theoretical physicist and professor in the Graduate Department of Physics at the City University of New York. And Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. Our number, 212-267-WNYC. We'll be right back. We're back with Please Explain on WNYC 93.9 AM 820 online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate talking with Neil deGrasse Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. His most recent book, Origins, 14 Billion Years of Cosmic History. And Michio Kaku is here, professor in the Graduate Department of Physics at the City University of New York, author most recently of Parallel Worlds, A Journey Through Creation, Higher Dimensions, and the Future of the Cosmos. And we are taking your calls at 212-267-WNYC. There are a lot of calls and very little time, so let's get right to them. Tim in Airmont. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hello. My question is very simple. If space is supposed to be curved, how can something which doesn't have any existence be curved? Doesn't have any, you know, it's got to, you know, everybody uses that example of the bed sheet and then the rubber mat and all that sort of stuff.
But you're saying space is
a rubber mat that's curved. Space is emptiness. How can emptiness be curved?
Yeah, well, that question bedeviled Einstein for the rest of his life. How can nothingness be curved? Well, that's just the way the world is. What can I say? You know, Einstein didn't create this out of nothing. He simply saw what the experimental data was, created a theory consistent with experimental data that allowed him to predict the deflection of light around the stars. Now, it's even worse than this. Dark energy is the energy of nothing. Empty space has energy, and that's what's blowing the universe apart. You mentioned the accelerating universe. Why don't black holes retard the acceleration of the universe? There's something even greater than a black hole. and that is the energy of nothing that this listener talked about. It overwhelms all black holes. 73% of the matter energy of the universe is in the form of dark energy, the energy of the vacuum.
And some people have said that was just a convenient invention of physicists to explain things they couldn't explain.
What, dark energy?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's a measured phenomenon. We don't know what it is, but we've got to give it a name, so we call it something. When we find out what it is, we'll get a better name, but it is a measured thing, and it is the word for the ignorance that prevails.
Let's take another call. James in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, professors. Thanks for coming on. I'd like to ask about, is there necessarily a space-time discontinuity at what we see as the Schwarzschild radius from where we're standing? If you got closer, would it move further away, down further into the black hole, and other things start disappearing from behind us?
Well, the Schwarzschild radius is the point of no return. When you pass this imaginary sphere called the Schwarzschild radius, you never come back. It's like a Roach Motel. When you pass that sign that said the Schwarzschild radius, you never come back. And then further, you eventually hit the black hole itself. So the Schwarzschild radius of a black hole is quite stationary, and when you approach it, it does not move. It's an imaginary radius, but when you fall through it, you never come back.
Well, explanations of how light works say that no matter how fast you're traveling, that light will continue at light speed ahead of you. The time-space, tends to stretch to accommodate the speed of light.
That's true, but in your own frame, as you fall into a black hole, things look very normal. It's very normal as you fall through the black hole. Now, from someone outside looking at you, light is distorted, so it takes you thousands of years to actually fall into a black hole as seen by someone from the outside. It appears as if time stops, but for you, the person falling into the black hole, it takes you about a millisecond to actually die as you fall through the event horizon or the Schwarzschild radius. So it's an optical illusion.
So the continuity continues to exist even though relative to the outside universe you tend to disappear.
Right. Now the real discontinuity takes place at the very center. At the very center, that's when Einstein's equations break down. We have to use string theory. Wormholes may open up. We don't know for sure. It's all speculation. But at the dead center, not inside, not the Schwarzschild radius, but at dead center, we may actually have a wormhole opening up, though that's not clear yet.
So in other words, think of the event horizon as a zone. It's not a surface. It's just a zone. If you're falling in it, you'll fall through that event horizon like you're just falling into anything. There's not a discontinuity to you in your experience. And that all happens before your atoms get ripped apart.
Now, the two of you tend to agree on everything. Does that mean that these days astrophysicists and theoretical physicists are in general agreement?
There's enough in the body of knowledge called physics that we're all trained in and we know it works, and we go on to the next problem. If you want battles and fistfights, you got to go to the very bleeding edge of what people say about how the universe works, and that's where you get it. But for standard physics, black hole is pretty much standard physics today. Not the singularity in the middle, but the rest of it is, we're just talking like we're just having lunch.
We know there's a black hole in the center of the Milky Way.
However, years ago, there was a lot of snickering. People would snicker when we mentioned black holes. But, you know, he who laughs last laughs best. And usually we physicists get the last laugh.
Can I assume that there's a black hole at the center of every galaxy?
The data are coming in to suggest that. That's right. We have a relatively modest-sized black hole. Some galaxies have super billions times the mass of the sun in black hole size. So some of us have like black hole envy because our black hole isn't as big as that of others. But there's some galaxies where the fact that they have a big black hole, it wreaks havoc in their center, and they have very active nuclei. And we can single out these galaxies in the cosmos for just that purpose.
We go to Anita in Manhattan next. Hi.
Hi. What I want to ask is, Dr. Kaku mentioned before the Big Bang, do theoretical physicists have theories about what existed before the Big Bang?
Yes. The dominant theory now, which does not mean it's correct, but the dominant theory now is that we have continual creation, continual genesis. This is called eternal inflation. Inflation says that universes can bud and sprout baby universes all the time, perhaps through black holes, and there's a continuous creation of soap bubbles. So we live in this huge arena of multi-soap bubbles, perhaps floating in 11-dimensional hyperspace. Big bangs have taken place since this radio program started. Perhaps there are baby universes being born even as we speak. And this, to me, is nice because it combines Buddhism with Judeo-Christian thinking. In Buddhism, there is no beginning, there's no end, there's timelessness of nirvana. So here we have Genesis constantly taking place in an ocean of 11-dimensional nirvana.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for calling us. Bree in the Bronx. Hi, you're on Leonard Lopez Show.
Hi there. My question is it true that we don't know what our own solar system really looks like and that we base what we think it looks like on, from looking at other solar systems?
Okay, I think you probably are thinking about what our galaxy looks like because our solar system is just our planets.
But Voyager photographed our solar system.
Right, no, solar system, I think she means the galaxy because we're embedded in the galaxy, enshrouded in with gas clouds, and we have better views of other galaxies than we have of our own. So the very first...
We're on the fringe of our own galaxy.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, two-thirds of the way out from the center. And so for decades, we had better views of other galaxies than we had of our own. In fact, we used the other galaxies to inform what our data means that we're taking on our own system. And part of the problem is it's the problem of the unborn child. If you ask it, what does your mother look like? It would have no clue because it's in it. And that was part of our challenges. Right now, we have found our galactic analogs in the universe. And in fact, if we ever show a picture of the Milky Way in that way, it's not because we got a bird's eye view of it. It's because we found galaxies that we're pretty sure are our twins. So you're exactly right. That was a very big challenge.
Thank you so much for calling us. Rosalie in Forest Hills.
Hello. Hi. My question is to either of the individuals. It has to do with the expansion of the universe. Recent thinking says that the universe is constantly expanding and expanding at even a faster rate than it ever was thought to.
Which Einstein predicted, although he later regretted making that prediction.
My question has to do with the red shift, which is often believed to be the experimental basis for this information. And I think they found just recently it's even faster, the red shift, than they thought it was. They thought the universe was collapsing a little now and going slower. But now that it seems to be getting even
We talked about that earlier. Is there a question at the end of this?
Yes, there is. It has to do with the fact that if, when we look back at other objects very distant, it's only the way things looked many millions or billions of years ago. The information is faulty, isn't it? Because it shows us what the universe really was doing billions of years ago, not what it's doing now or in the future.
Exactly right. Good when question. We look billions of years into the past, we find the universe was expanding slower than we thought, which means that comparatively we are speeding up to where it was billions of years ago. And so this is rather a frightening thought because it means that the laws of physics in some sense could be a death warrant to all intelligent life in the universe, that one day the universe is going to freeze over into a big freeze. And that's why I advocate, which is, of course, controversial, I advocate that at some point billions of years from now, we may have to leave the universe. We may have no choice. The laws of physics are a death warrant, but a loophole. The loophole is to go through the rabbit hole, to go through the looking glass, and escape to another warmer universe.
But I think what the caller was concerned about is we are making statements about a universe that is not the current universe, about the past universe. And why should that tell us anything about the current universe? And so what we do is we see galaxies moving in this fabric of space and time. And you turn the clock back, you can say, well, what might it have been doing yesterday or a year ago or 1,000 years ago or billions of years ago? And it's not much of a stretch to make that assumption. And that's what we do, and that's how we map out the timeline of the cosmos.
Now, we pretty much run out of time, and we have some very good questions coming in. So let me just put two together and get as quick an answer as possible. Do black holes expand? And what does a black hole look like from underneath? Do they defy gravity?
Well, black holes definitely expand in the sense they constantly eat new material. Stephen Hawking has pioneered that concept, therefore giving what is called an entropy or a temperature to a black hole. They're spherical, and so you can't really say what a black hole looks like from underneath. However, you cannot really photograph the black hole itself. We photograph the gas swirling into the black hole. The event horizon itself is probably grayish.
And I have to leave it at that, unfortunately. Michio Kaku is actually speaking at the Hayden Planetarium this coming Monday at 7:30. My great thanks to him and to the director of the Hayden Planetarium, Neil deGrasse Tyson, for being my guest today on today's Please Explain. That's it for today's show. I hope you've enjoyed it. Melissa Egan is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray, the associate producer. Sarah English and Brenna Farrell, the assistant producers. And we had help today from Josh Ward, Blakeney Schick, Nick Gelowitz, and contributing producer Bonnie LeFave. Elena Nacantha was at the audio controls with help from Aaron Cohn. Our original theme music is by They Might Be Giants. I'm Leonard Lope, your host. The Pope's health situation has a lot of people speculating just who might be his successor. On Monday, we will look behind the scenes of papal death and succession. And then Sue Bloland, the daughter of renowned psychologist Eric Erickson, tries to balance her father's very different public image and private life.
Thanks for checking out today's podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.